Ladies and gentlemen, please rise. This court is now in session.
Good morning. Please be seated. You may call the case. 3-22-0178, Jose Woodmeyer and Juan Aguirre, appellees by Jim Confederate v.
Rockford System, Inc., formerly an Illinois corporation, et al., appellant by Melissa Dockage.
Mr.
Dockage,
if you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May I please support counsel? The matters before this court are two certified questions regarding the application of Section 1280 of the Business Corporation Act. It's known as the Corporate Survival Statute. The first question asks whether the current version of the statute, which became effective on January 1st, 2015, can be applied retroactively, where the plaintiff suffered his injury after the defendant corporation dissolved. Under the version of the Corporate Survival Statute that affected the time Rockford Systems dissolved, the dissolution of a corporation would not impair any civil remedy available against the corporation for any right or claim existing or any liability incurred prior to such dissolution. Here, it's undisputed that Rockford Systems dissolved on November 20, 2014, Mr. Barajas did not suffer his injury until August 4, 2017. The second certified question addresses the five-year corporate survival period set forth in either version of the corporate survival statute, and it asks whether the relation back doctrine under Section 616 of the Code of Civil Procedure allows a plaintiff to amend his complaint to include for the first time dissolved corporation after the running of the five-year corporate survival period. Although this is here on 308, there's just a few dates that may be helpful in analyzing this matter. In July 15, 2009, Rockford Systems delivered a barrier guard to what's called a bliss machine at the place of Mr. Greyhouse employment. On November 20th, 2014, Rockford Systems dissolved by filing articles of dissolution, and it ceased to exist 5 years later on November 20th, 2019. On August 4th, 2017, Mr. Barajas suffered his injury. On August 2nd of 2019, nearly 2 years later, Mr. Barajas filed his suit, but against other defendants and not the dissolved corporations. In February 2020, Mr. Barajas amended his suit to include for the first time the dissolved corporations. So, question one. The version of the Corporate Survival Act in effect at the time Rockford Systems dissolved in 2014 provided that the dissolution of a corporation would not, impair any civil remedy available or any right or claim existing or any liability incurred prior to such dissolution. Under the version of the statute that came into effect January 1st, 2015, the dissolution of a corporation would not impair any civil remedy or any liability incurred either prior to, at the time of, or after such dissolution. If we apply the statute that was in effect at the time Rockford Systems dissolved, Mr. Barajas would not have had a cause of action at all because his injury occurred after Rockford Systems dissolved. Under this version of the statute in effect in 2015, Mr. Barajas could have a cause of action because his injury occurred during that five-year corporate windup period as long as Mr. Barajas had filed his lawsuit within that five-year corporate windup period. So which version of the statute applies? To answer this question, we cite in our brief to Perry versus Department of Management and Professional Regulation, an Illinois Supreme Court case from 2018. The case involved a two consolidated cases involving records requests under FOIA. After the requesters requested their requests and were denied, they filed their lawsuits. And while those cases were pending, the disclosure laws were amended to exempt the information the requesters sought. Now, the department argued that the court should apply the amendments that were in effect at the time of the court's decision. The requesters, on the other hand, said the law should apply at the time they initially made their requests. The Perry Court provides a very good retroactivity analysis. It really takes many steps and shows us how you should do this. While it discusses at length the analysis itself, the first question at least, is a fairly straightforward one. Did the legislature expressly prescribe that the statute was to be applied retroactively? Now, the legislature's intent is best indicated by the plain language of the statute itself. In fact, as long as the statute itself is clear, the court doesn't need to look to any other extrinsic evidence.
What about Pronger?
Pronger?
So, in other words, my question being that Pronger seems to suggest that, and I would concede there's nothing in the text of the statute to speak to its temporal reach, but Pronger says we look, it's not just the text, we look to essentially legislative history or the reasons for the amendment, and we have some reasons here.
Well, first I'll address Pronger, which was decided before the Supreme Court decision.
Right.
Pronger was an interesting case in that the Pronger court came down and said it was really a procedural decision, right? Because what had happened is there were parental rights involving a five-month-old child. This case had gone on for several years. There were over 15 hearings. And at each of the hearings, the infant child was represented by a guardian ad litem. It was only after these 15 hearings and the course of years elapsed that the mother's rights were terminated that she said, well, wait a minute, you never had jurisdiction over the infant child because you never personally served. The Pronger court did look to some of the history, but it really came down on the decision saying this was procedural. This is just a matter of how do we serve summons and hail people into court. I would also say that the history in this part, although the legislature clearly wanted to amend the statute, and I think it was in response to the PLF decision, the legislature didn't say it wanted to apply the statute retroactively. And historically, from 1933 on, the statute has always said that injuries occurred prior to dissolution were the cases that could be brought forward. The legislature amended the statute several times. In 1933, I think it was a two-year corporate survival period. In 1985, it was amended to be a five-year corporate survival period. The Pielet decision itself, the Illinois Supreme Court, said it was following the decision of prior courts. It was not an outlier. It was not changing the law. It was applying the law as it had been applied. So I don't think there's this long history of making a problem with this statute. I think the legislature didn't like the effect of this decision in PLA. They had amended the statute. But they amend statutes all the time. It doesn't mean that the statute needs to be applied retroactively.
In the briefs, you point out that Pielet and the amendment, at least in legislative history, they were concerned with breach of contract. But you're not arguing that to the extent that 12.8 applies, it only applies to those types of cases.
Not at all, okay. But that was the concern of the legislature,
sure,
that a corporation couldn't enter into a contract and dissolve it without consequence during the windup. So we're talking about the plain language of the statute itself. This statute doesn't include any language to the effect of, you know, this amendment applies to all claims pending on or filed after the effective date of this amendment. I use that language because you find that language in the Wrongful Death Act. Or, for example, Lazenby versus Marks Construction, an Illinois case, or Illinois Supreme Court case from 2010, cited in the briefs, it was an amendment to the Fire Investigation Act. And that amendment expressly stated, this section applies to all causes of action that have accrued, will accrue, or are currently pending. Again, there is no such express language in the amended version of 1280. The legislature certainly knew how to do that. It has done it, and it didn't do that in this situation. The parties also cite to the case Hayashi versus Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. That case involved healthcare providers who challenged the retroactive application of a statute that required the revocation of their medical licenses. The statutes went into effect after the healthcare providers had been found guilty of crimes involving sexual misconduct against their patients. The relevant language of the statute said, you know, when a healthcare worker has been convicted, not is convicted, has been convicted, took a little grammar lesson, has been is the present perfect, which means beginning in the past and continuing in the present.
I always find it amusing that we ascribe such knowledge of grammar to the legislature. Let me ask about two other cases more specifically. It seems to me we have these two cases. Moore's the minor case where they extended it, and then the other case, the name of which escapes me, where the voluntary dismissal for a year. What about those two cases? Are they good law? And if they are good law, don't they inform what we should do here?
Well, in Moore, the court did acknowledge that the corporate survival statute is just that, but the court expressed a special consideration for the rights of minors.
But how did they have the power to do that if, in fact, the corporate survival statute means what it says?
Your Honor, I don't know how they had the power to do it, because I think the corporate survival statute does mean what it says. But I can tell you that that Moore decision has been limited to its facts, and it hasn't been used by the courts since then. In fact, the Michigan-Indiana Condominium Court, the same first district in 2014, limited the holding to its particular facts. There's also something that happened in Moore that didn't happen here, and it's, we didn't cite it in the papers, but rereading Moore last night, I noticed this. In Moore, the plaintiff had contacted the dissolved corporation prior to its dissolution, and it had filed a claim of leave, an attorney's leave. And the insurance adjuster for the corporation and the plaintiff had been in communication for years regarding this claim of lien regarding the plaintiff's injury. Those communications went on from 1975 to 1978 when, for reasons that are unexplained, the insurance adjuster decided not to settle the claim. Later in 1978, the corporation dissolved. And part of the issue is the plaintiff claimed they had never had notice of the dissolution and that they were a claimant. So while that doesn't answer your question, how does the court have the power to do what the court did, I think it informs a little bit of what that court's decision was, not just the right of minors, but the fact that there was a claim that the corporation knew about prior to its dissolution. And again, I would also say other cases have cited MS versus Dinkytown Daycare Center. That's a South Dakota decision. Obviously, it's not binding, but it's I think it's helpful. There they affirmed the dismissal of the guardian litem's complaint against a dissolved daycare center, that it was argued that the daycare center had allowed sexual abuse of these young children to occur. They said that the complaint was time-barred, even though it involved minors, and even though it involved terrible facts. According to that court, the corporate survival statutes create both the right to sue a dissolved corporation and the conditions which must be fully complied with for the right to resist. I know my time is coming to
you. You're not quite time barred yet, but yes. You're getting it.
Are there any questions?
Justice Peterson?
No.
Justice Davenport?
No.
Thank you very much. You'll have an opportunity in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. McFedrin.
May it please the court. Morning, Your Honor. Please support. For the record, my name is Attorney James McFedrin, arguing this morning on behalf of plaintiffs with a Barajas and Montefiore, and for the record, plaintiff Barajas is in open court this morning. The court's heard the questions, you've read the questions, unless the court needs me to do so, I'm not going to go into restating the questions the counsel has appropriately referenced. In the incident case, 12.80, in regard to the first question, should definitely be applied retroactively, although I also take issue we have throughout the case as to whether, given the legislative history following the amendment, that even the original version should not be applied to support the plaintiff in the incident case. The Supreme Court at the time Pilot was decided did not have the benefit of the legislative history that came after. And indeed, that was a central tenet on which the Supreme Court based. Check paragraph 48 of the opinion in the Supreme Court decision in Pilot, referenced that the appellate court had held different. And the Supreme Court said that it was relying on the point that there had been no legislative history given a concern or question about the cases that have been decided for years, finding that you couldn't have a cause of action when the final part of making the cause of action accrued after.
The certified questions, however, seem to presume that otherwise you wouldn't be able to proceed. Is that fair?
Excuse me, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
The certified questions don't ask us to address that issue.
Not in regard to question one, but it's relevant on question two.
How so?
Well, because question two doesn't say which statute you're talking about. It says
well, question two is a relation back question.
Well, if we're limiting it to that, then okay.
Well, I'm not limiting it. Isn't that what it says?
It says limiting it in regard to ILCS 5.12.0. It doesn't talk about which version. But it, in regard to the relation back, you know, we believe that's the question. But getting back to this, Your Honor, Justice Brennan, you were correct in referencing the Pronger case and raising questions, and that was something that the trial court relied upon in the incident case, too, in denying a motion to dismiss prior to certifying the questions. And in regard to Pronger, it found that that was procedural and based upon the legislative history. And that is similar to the incident case herein. We maintain that it's procedural as well. The trial court also referenced the Walden Home versus Schmidt case as an indication and citing it in regard to, it's also another survival statute, and it deals with survival of remedy. It also can't be disputed that.
Can I ask a question about Walden Homes? So in Walden Homes, what say you about the distinction between so in Walden Homes, it was a remedy or right that was recognized in the common law. Here, I mean, corporations are creatures of statute. The ability to sue them, not sue them, it's and when you can sue them after dissolution, again, entirely a creature of statute, not recognized in any sense in the common law. Does that, what do you say about the defendant's distinguishing of Walden Homes based upon that?
I think there's a distinction there, but it doesn't make a difference in the big picture, because I think that the amendment to the statute here simply clarified the existing law, and I'll get into that. And that, and when you get into that aspect of it, you don't even need to address Pronger, you don't even need to address Walden Homes, and when you get into that. But I think that it still is a matter of procedure. Filing a lawsuit when the time frame is still a method of procedure, same as issuing summons, which was involved in the Pronger case. So I think that it's still a method of procedure. The cause of action, the right existed when the alleged negligence in regard to creating the alleged effective guard that counsel referenced that my client wants to have decided on the merit for, that was a cause of losing his hand.
But there's no cause of action until the injury.
There's no cause of action, but Section 12.80 doesn't say you have to have a cause of action. It's right or claim. And that's the part that the appellate court sees on, and I think that's the part that the legislative history goes back in and says that's why the injustice of what happened to the widow in Peel, it shouldn't have occurred had the Supreme Court had the guidance of the legislative history as to what their intent was, which they didn't have in 2012. But right after that, the legislature got to work and said, hey, the Supreme Court got it wrong in 2013, and in fact, the statute was even amended as far as passing the legislatures and passing and signed by the governor even before their dissolution became final. So I believe that the intention here, and there's also the point in the law in general wherein when the amendment to the statute takes place shortly following, this is in the Bailey case, it's mentioned, that was the unemployment case. When there's an amendment to the statute that takes place shortly following a decision of the court, there's a tenet in the law that almost presumes that the intention is to correct the error. And as Your Honor pointed out in his question there, there should be no meaningful distinction between whether it's a contract action or a tort action. Indeed, counsel and defense, resourceful counsel, have been arguing for a couple of years that Peelit was the central tenet on which they built their defense to our positions, and that was a contract action. So I think that there's no question but that when you consider everything in context here, the point that the legislature, I believe, intended originally to have the survival statute apply to a case such as this where the right to be free from having a negligent guard in 2009 where an accident happened. It may have been a contingent cause of action. It doesn't happen until you have the accident. But the right to be free from that negligence to have as a product, that was there originally. The cause of action didn't ripen until later. We have to acknowledge that. So, but it's or. And that's how you get the fact, because the legislature didn't have the benefit of it, was incorrectly decided as fine. And there is reference in the legislative history by Senator Harmon, even to products liability issues. I know they talk about contract and tort and everything, which she's backed off that position now. But there's no question about that in that particular case. It was supportive of our client's position here when you consider the total context here. So when you take the combination of, we believe it is procedural, I also, and that Judge, now Justice Harold, reasoning and rationale, we believe was correct. But aside from that, the additional central basis on which to uphold the bottom line decision to deny a motion to dismiss and answer question one in the affirmative is clearly that it's a correction of a prior incorrect interpretation, and that has a presumption that it will be applied retroactively as well as prospectively. And then we get to the point where the specific language of the statute, notwithstanding counsel's resourceful arguments in suggesting that when the legislature talked about in the amendment how you have a dissolution, whether it be filing your articles, etc., etc., that, however, is not the part of the statute that also talks about the temporal portion. The temporal portion is talked about later on, where it talks about applying to all rights or causes of action that occur prior to the time of the subsequent. That's a reference to application to all of them. That would include the plaintiff's action that also occurred within the 5-year time period and also occurred subsequent to the enactment of the statute. All of their cases involving the statute in regard to 12.80, all of their cases don't involve a circumstance such as that here. When you talk about retroactivity, all of the facts in suit, whether it's Perry, whether it's ComEd case, Cavani, any of them that they cite, all of the facts in suit happened before. Here, the accident happened after the statute was enacted. So there's that point as well. So for all of these things, we think that when you consider that it's procedural, when you consider, we suggest it is, but aside from that, it is clearly a correction of an interpretation. That indicates it should be applied retroactively, and there's no reason to go against that tenet. They try and distinguish it in the reply brief. I suggest they didn't come up with a cogent basis, and the portion of the Bailey decision that references, and that was the unemployment case, when you have such a matter, that there's a general, almost a presumption that it is intended to be applied retroactively. So you don't even need to get into the specific language point. But the specific language is supportive too, and that our language here is similar to Lazenby. They try and distinguish that too. I suggest that when you're talking about rights or causes of action occurring prior to at the time of or subsequent, that encompasses our accident, wherein the right existed back when they put the guard in to have not have people be subject to an injury like this, and it ripened into a cause of action when the accident happened in 2017, also within the 5-year time period. And I suggest, Your Honor, the reasons that cases such as Moore and Pear were decided is they were read in peri materia in the statutes. And I think that's in somewhat what the trial court was doing, too. In those cases, in the Pear case, it had to do with the statute allowing non-suits and cases to be brought within a year. And in the other cases, the statute allowing minors to be sued. Herein, and this gets into question two, herein you have the combination of that statute, 12.80, and the amendment, and you have 2616D, which unquestionably says that relation back applies, and then the case is considered timely filed.
So all the cases that, and this is not a rhetorical question, but is it correct that all the cases that are cited that you use to say that relation back should apply, they're all statutes of limitation cases for the most part. None of them are a corporate dissolution case. And I ask this question because the corporate survival statute, we have case law that says it's not a statute of limitations. It's a basically an exception to the common law that says you can never sue a dissolved corporation. So is that distinction meaningful, in your opinion, in any way?
It's a distinction that they've raised, and I do not think that it's meaningful to have that distinction. I think that...
Can you relate back to sue a corporation that no longer exists and where the common law said you could never sue, and the only reason you can sue is this survival statute?
Well, I think you have to consider the statutes in peri materia. you know, every survival statute, whatever you want to call it, is a statute of limitations.
We don't have that many survival. I mean, it's an unusual thing. So is it a statute of limitations?
But it doesn't matter. Because 2616D and the specific language of 616D, and that's what they've tried to hang their hat on being resourceful, it's not limited to statutes of limitation. It says, and you need to consider the purpose of 616D too, and having cases, having that section liberally construed and to do justice and having cases not decide, having them decide on the merits. But when you consider the specific language, it doesn't say statute of limitations. It's any statute or contract which limits or prescribes the time frame within which a cause of action may be brought. And that statute extending the life of a corporation is without question a statute that limits the time that you can sue a corporation. And when you read those statutes in pari materia, and when you consider the liberal construction that all cases say you should have in 616D, you get to the specific language in that statute. They can't overcome them. As Justice Heddle indicated, he didn't find anything against it. And he also felt, and he didn't say the word pari materia, but that when you have one statute that extends to life, and you have another statute that says that if a relation back applies, that there was no reason why that should be not read together. And I believe that he was correct on that. Because when relation back applies, the case is treated as filed within the 5 years. And it is a statute limiting the time within which you can sue. They can be creative as they wish in regard to the English language, but the specific language of that statute is clear. And there's no basis or reason why this court should not just apply the statute as written in pari materia with the other statute and the amendment. And when you then consider it, with the totality of the circumstances herein, wherein our case is filed timely, we have service on Rockford Systems LLC within the 5 years. They get an extension because we're civility, we give extensions to plead, we don't take up the court's time. We don't find out that the 5 year solvent is over.
Mr. McFedrin, thank you. Justice Peterson, any questions?
No.
Justice Davenport?
No.
Thank you very much.
May I just say one statement?
You may wind up, yes.
She's going to have a final opportunity to speak here. All
she
I want
is.
You to know is that whatever she says, I would have, with all due respect, have an answer for.
Thank you.
I don't get a chance.
If that's a motion for sir rebuttal, it's denied.
I always hear that from the defense counsel at trial.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. McFedrin, we'd probably take judicial notice of that you would have an answer for anything that she says.
Ms. Dakich.
Just a few points in rebuttal. The amendment isn't merely a clarification. To clarify, to make a statement less confusing or more clearly comprehensible. Here, the legislature amended the statute to cure what it perceived was an unfair result and not to simply clarify the existing law.
Do you agree, though, that I can't stand legislative history, but setting that aside for a moment, do you agree that there's language in the legislative history that suggests it was intended to clarify?
I will say they used the word clarify.
They did.
But I don't think it can be considered a clarification. The reason is it actually changes the substantive effect of the law. It certainly does on my clients, the dissolved corporation.
Seems to ignore prior to, which seems very clear.
Again, this is a long history where the statute hadn't been changed. and the courts had interpreted the statute at the time it existed. I don't think Piola got the decision wrong.
So are you asking us to say, I can't remember whether it was Barbara Flynn Curry or Senator Harmon, but are you asking us to say that notwithstanding that they said this was a clarification, that's not what they meant or that's not what it was?
I don't think that's what it was, because it's not a technical correction. It expands the law. They wanted to change the law. Perhaps they thought that the law should have said that all the time, but we don't know what they thought. We do know what the law has said for decades. And if they thought it should be read differently, they might have used the language to clarify. But in fact, they did change the law after Piola. And I understand that it was in response to the Piola decision, in part. But again, the legislature can amend a statute at any time. It doesn't mean that that amendment is intended to be applied retroactively. In fact, the default is amendments to statutes are applied prospectively only. I'm not going to go back into the language. If they felt so clearly that this was a clarification, they didn't use any of that language in amending the statute. I would go on, too, to say that, as the Perry Court noted, even a statute that amended the scope of information you could get under FOIA, that was substantive. It changed the law, because at the time those requesters requested the information, they could have had the information, and under the amended version, they no longer had access to that information. It was substantive. Procedural changes go to pleadings, evidence, steps in practice. The cases that we've cited, a plaintiff has cited, talk about the manner in which the court is run. How do you get service on a minor? Even statute limitations. Again, the corporate survival statute that this court has observed is not a statute of limitation. Statutes of limitations address causes of action, like the facts that enable a person to bring a case against somebody else. The facts here would have to include injury, contrary to plaintiff's argument that the cause of action arose in 2019 when the guard to a list machine was first installed.
2009,
I'm sorry. There was no cause of action then. Plaintiff couldn't have brought a claim then. Plaintiff had to suffer an injury in order to have a cause of action. Statute of limitations just cut off the time a cause of action may be pursued. A statute of limitations doesn't create a cause of action.
Hasn't the Third District characterized the Corporate Survival Act as a statute of repose?
Yes, and in our papers we say the Seventh District had characterized that as a statute of repose as well. I would go with the Fourth District and the Gillespie Community Unit School District number 7 that says it's not a statute of repose. It's stronger than a statute of repose. A statute of repose and a statute of limitation are kind of, in essence, arbitrary cutoffs. They don't distinguish a cause of, or extinguish a cause of action. They merely say you can no longer bring a cause of action.
Thank you, Ms. Dakich. The court, I apologize. Justice Peterson, a question?
I actually do have one question. So the second certified question, in the second paragraph, makes a presumption. It says, plaintiff later properly amends the complaint under the relation back doctrine. Separate from your argument with regard to the survival statute is what your defense is. So if you've agreed to that statement and certified, that's never coming up again? The actual procedurally filing because this, the word properly is in the question, so I just want to make sure that's never going to, because that's part of our analysis on the very initial issue of whether we should exercise jurisdiction.
Your Honor, we agreed for purposes of 308 that the real issue was the assumption that the plaintiff otherwise complied with 616 in order to get the question to this court without any factual predicate. The circuit court ruled that they had complied with 616. I may not agree with that, but that is a factual question for the circuit court, and we certainly couldn't argue against that for this court.
So what you're telling me is this could come up again. It may be back here someday on that issue.
Your Honor, I can't have my clients say that we would never break.
Sure. Them. No, I understand that. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
Justice Davenport, any additional questions?
As a grammarian, thanks for the analysis of past perfect and present perfect. I'm forgetting that ever again. So,
I'm not sure if I ever knew that growing up.
The court thanks both sides for their arguments. The matter will be taken under advisement, and an opinion and/or Rule 23 order will issue.